Let's cut to the chase. The world of work is changing. There's no stopping that change. Welcome to the Better Work Project, brought to you by the team at SoftEd. I am your host, David Mantica, and joining me as co-host is Andy Cooper. In this podcast, we will explore the changing world of work, what the future of work means, how it affects businesses and workers alike, and how we can create more productive and engaged workplaces. I hope you join us for the ride. Enjoy. Welcome back to the Better Work Project, episode 18. Yes, episode 18. Very excited about that. We have not been canceled yet, thankfully. So say hello, Andy.
Hi. Happy Thanksgiving from last week.
That's right. Thank you. And we all learned what Thanksgiving was all about last week. That was very good. Although I think Lauren might have cut off a lot of it because she's very mean. Say hello, Lauren.
Hello.
Yeah, Lauren is our producer.
How is everyone?
Yeah, I don't think everybody's happy because I know you're the producer and you chop everything up.
Everyone being yourself?
Yes, you cut me constantly. it hurts. I cried the last time I listened to our last podcast. You made me cry. How do you feel about making me cry?
Part delighted, part sad for you.
I'm sure you are delighted that you made me cry. Andy probably was there instigating you. Hey, chop that word. Make him say this.
I don't need make you say anything. You do it all yourself.
Yes, I do. It's kind of pathetic. So I am, again, surrounded by Wellingtonians, and you'll get introduced to Ian Frazier here in just a little bit. So Wellingtonians being wonderful people from Wellington, New Zealand, a beautiful city, the windiest city in the world. And since we got these two sides of the world thing that we talk about in this podcast, I wanted to talk about Christmas traditions, since we're just starting the Christmas holiday here. So on the Wellingtonian side, the Wellington side, Andy or Lauren, what's a couple of Christmas traditions you want to tell the audience about?
That's a good question. Well, we have Christmas in the summertime. So one of my family's traditions, when I go to visit them, we go for a walk around Mount Maunganui. And it's usually very sunny, which is a little bit different to what we have here in Wellington. How about you, Andy?
Yeah, my family, Christmases are always in Wellington, which has less predictable weather, let's put it that way. Yeah. But we do try and barbecue if possible and take advantage of our swimming pool if it's a warm day, which happens about once every 5 years.
What's interesting is when I talk to the Australians and their crazy Christmas, which is basically, 40 degrees centigrade and then in the beach swimming around like crazies?
Yeah, we do the beach if it's warm enough.
Yeah, but the Australians, that's what all they do, isn't it? They just go to the beach?
I think they've got a heat wave at the moment, so that's probably a place to be.
Well, here's my problem with that. From an Australia perspective, who in their right mind would go to the beach on Christmas where everything in that country can kill you? Like, I would just stay in my house. I'd be too scared.
It begs the question why you just go to Australia in the first place, but we won't go into that.
And now, talking about those critters, I believe that there are no snakes in New Zealand. Is that correct?
Are we talking about Australians? Or?
Oh, no, we're talking about New Zealand now. Oh, snakes, yeah. Well, if there's Australians in New Zealand, that might... Well, I'm not going to say that because I don't want to get in trouble. That would be me making fun of Canadians, by the way. So, what were you going to say, Lauren? Are there snakes in New Zealand?
We're predator-free, so no snakes in New Zealand.
And then, do you have a special name for Santa Claus there?
Father Christmas.
Is that primary, Father Christmas?
Actually, I think people use one or the other.
Is it? Now, do you have Rudolph there?
We're not that different. Yes, we do.
We're not that different. We have Rudolph there. I wish we didn't have Rudolph here, to be honest with you, but that's a whole other subject. There's only so much of the red-nosed reindeer I can take. Anyways, pretty interesting conversation around Christmas. So for next episode, I want to talk about the worst and the best Christmas gifts. So be thinking about that if you care to mention them. Because Andy, I think you got a really good Christmas gift from somebody one time that you mentioned a while back. So I want to hear that story again. So let's jump to the topic. I think you both are kind of bored with the Christmas topic. Let's get into the real meat of the presentation, which is the future of project management. And it is a big, deep, and wonderful topic we're going to cover. And we have a fantastic expert that's going to really dig into this topic. And we got a chance to read an interview he did recently as well on this topic to add a lot of value to it. And we'll probably throw some quotes and some ideas that he had presented from that interview. in this podcast, I hope, for that. So we're talking about this idea of the future of project management. And when you think about this, and we think about all things project management, you know, how is project management impacted by the changing way we work? And what will it look like in the future? Remember, this podcast is all about the changing way of work, the Better Work Project. So we have to start thinking about projects. So how do we think about projects? Well, when we think about projects, we think about them from the iron triangle perspective: time, budget, scope. But what about customer value? And how do we elevate projects to a product and a portfolio view? We're going to dive into these questions today and a whole lot more. And the wild thing about this is there's a rough estimates there can be anywhere up to 16 million people who consider themselves a project manager in the world. So this impacts a lot of workers. And so we're delighted to introduce a very special guest and a member of the wider SoftEd team, Ian Fraser. Ian is a PMI fellow, has served on the PMI Global Board, and he chaired it in 2006, is the former CEO of Project Plus, and is a member of the SoftEd Board. He is also the author of a book, The Business of Portfolio Management, Boosting Organizational Value, and other titles. Ian, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for joining us today.
Hey, good stuff, David. Thank you so much for the invitation. It's great to be here.
Yeah, we absolutely love having you. Thank you for joining us. And I'm going to pass over the duties of talking to Lauren. You're probably all sick of hearing me anyways. Lauren, dig on in.
Thanks, Dave. And welcome, Ian. Now, I want to start off with the tough stuff. Let's start by addressing project failure. So only 19% of organizations deliver successful projects, according to research by the International Project Management Association. So, Ian, why is this? Do we need to change the way that we manage projects? And do current project management approaches adequately deal with complexity and uncertainty?
Yeah, wow. Great start, Lauren. Thank you. And nice to talk with you again. And David wasn't kidding when we were going to ask some curly questions and get right into it. Look, I think those statistics associated with project failure have bounced around 20 to 30% for quite some time, actually. And I think when you convert that into some dollar terms, which PMI have done on a few occasions as part of their research, it amounts to a huge amount of money. I seem to remember one time, 13% of all investment was getting wasted as a consequence of project failure. I think to your point, and why is this? I think we need to remind ourselves that projects are different. And when I say projects, I include programs and for that matter, perhaps portfolios. And I suspect we'll get on to talk about that. But they're different from normal business or operations management or whatever one might call it, business as usual is another expression. And they're different in so much that they're one-off endeavors. They're undoubtedly have considerable amounts of inherent risks, some more than others. They often have a fair degree of complexity. And often, and this is maybe a little bit of an insight here, we see people being kind of mismatched in terms of their capability versus the complexity and the inherent risk associated with the endeavor they're trying to push through and deliver against. So to me, the 19%, Lauren, that you mentioned could in fact be seen by some as somewhat acceptable in so much that there always will be failures. I think it'd be naive and impossible to ever have a world full of projects, particularly in the future, that have zero failure, irrespective of how we define failure, but have zero. I think that's impossible because of the four things I just mentioned.
Yeah, that's really interesting talking about the tolerance for failure. David, what are your thoughts on that?
What I was thinking about there was this idea that of the failures, where did the failure occur? Because I don't think the failure occurs in the fact that the people don't do their work appropriately and that the work product isn't completed. I think the failures really occur in that what was completed, was it actually used? Or was it actually useful? Or did the project take so long that the world changed by the time the project was done? So, and I also agree with Ian in the fact that there's got to be some level of acceptable, oh, we made a mistake. And that should be included in any type of estimate because we're not perfect. And the world changes and it continues to change so rapidly. So what I would love is, one, to dig deeper into that number to find out if most, if not all, the failure happened at the planning stage or at the visioning stage, or two, it happened because the project just took longer and the world changed. And then from there, getting people comfortable with failure and learning from it and adapting midstream so that ultimately the output changes and you just do something different because you learned. And so that would be interesting to see as well.
So Andy, David was talking about failure in terms of waste. Do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, well, I think that's often the biggest cause of failure is, I think the stat that the PMI talked about was up to 64% of features that are built are never used. And I think that speaks to, you know, of the traditional Big Bang, do the heavy requirements up front, think you've got them covered, and then deliver them, and then find out that what people said they thought they want, they actually don't need. So that's part of the issue as well, is that. And then, of course, that creates a huge amount of technical debt that builds up over time with all this waste. So I think waste is a key factor that delays value. And that comes down to the approach often as well, where we do this often big upfront planning, heavy focus on requirements, and then a long phase delivery, the traditional waterfall model. Thankfully, that's shifting and changing, and more organizations are now using agile approaches. But I think there are other factors as well. I think, again, in the PMI reports that, and I've seen this talked about from agile project delivery as well, that often when the agile or waterfall projects fail, one of the key factors is a lack of executive involvement and executive alignment. And that's for a range of reasons. I think that's partly just to make sure that whatever the project was there to do is actually delivering against the specific strategic goals and initiatives that it was set up to do. It's also hopefully, again, another checkpoint to avoid extra waste. But it's also, I think, the key thing that the Scrum Alliance has found that is really critical in project delivery, having an executive team that can actually remove impediments quickly allows projects to run much faster. So I think executive alignment is a key aspect of high performing projects, and low performing ones often don't have that. And so that's another key factor. I think the other one, and we'll probably talk about that later on, is too much focus on the output of the project, not enough focus on the outcomes that are needed to be delivered. And I think that's a big shift as well. It's much more focus on outcomes and the language around that. Why are we doing this? What do we need to deliver to achieve those outcomes? Less focus on features and functions and the traditional triangle, much more focus on benefits, benefit realization.
And just picking up your point, Andy, agility isn't new to the project world, but interestingly, less than half of organizations are using an agile delivery approach. Ian, how can we build an agile delivery mindset?
Yeah, look, it's an awesome question. And I think, you know, there's a couple of caveats with that, I guess. I think the agile movement really has been centered around and still is the ICT sector. And as you all know, it originated out of software development and it sort of expanded a bit into software management, I guess, it might be, or ICT management. That said, I think there is an opportunity to be nimble and adaptive within any organization, irrespective of what sector they may work within. And that doesn't necessarily mean ICT, for example. I think to me, there's a number of things that if we look out into the future that are paramount to think about from a business leadership perspective, from an adaptive nimbleness perspective. To me, the first thing is we need to simplify our businesses. And like yourselves, I'm sure you've heard a few horror stories about agile transformation, which just builds process on top of other processes that exist within the organization, chokes the organization, experiencing that stuff, and really gains nothing. So to me, I think the start point is how can we deliver that mindset is look at the business and actually look at simplifying the business in terms of making it easier to pivot, making it easier to change, making it easier to work through issues, problems, etc., that project teams, program teams, and other teams might be facing. I think the second thing then is, based on that age of simplification, is building a business philosophy around what I would term the three P's to success. So it's purpose, people, and performance. And that purpose and people emphasis really goes and gives a nod towards a culture that you might desire within an organization, as opposed to the climate which may exist currently, which purports or masquerades what the culture might be. A fourth thing I would bet is this whole nimbleness, as I said, agility, Lauren, you used, and this need to focus on the right things. And I think that's very easy to say, I think very difficult to do unless you simplify the business. And one more to me is about the notion of lean. Lean has been, the lean methodology has been around for a long time now. Thank you to our Japanese friends, originated out of manufacturing. And what lean taught us was the ability to speed up, the ability to reduce waste. And we started this conversation by talking about wastage. Gosh, if we just simplified our business, allowed the business to speed up, reduce waste, at the same time maintaining quality, of course, we go a long way to, I think, addressing some of the challenges that we're going to see in the short term as well as the midterm.
Yeah, Ian, really interesting point about simplification. And we spoke about this in a podcast we did a few weeks back.
All right.
About startup culture and how large organizations can suffer from overcomplication. Andy, I want to bring you in here. There's lots to unpack. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I think the mindset shift is a big part from deliver, sort of like thinking big, but then delivering big, to still thinking big, but sort of acting quickly and then learning. So the fast feedback loops that you get from a more iterative approach, as opposed to this much slower learning you get from a much more staged delivery approach. I think that's a big shift that's starting to occur, but still see the large projects that often get in trouble are the ones that don't follow that type of approach. And even a lot of agile programs that I've seen or that I work with are still delivered in what we call agile water scrumful, which effectively means that the requirements are often done in a non-agile manner. The actual operational side is done in a non-agile manner. And it's only really the build that's done somewhat in an agile manner. So we still really haven't even really realized the value of an agile approach, even nearly 20 years after the Agile Manifesto. So we've still got a long way to go in actually delivering on this premise of nimbleness.
And David, what do you want to add to that? Agile water scrumful is a mouthful. How do we move to a more agile way of thinking and working?
Well, it's interesting. I love Ian's comments around the mindset shift. Like he wasn't going to sit there and say, hey, we got to go agile and then agile in the practice. And even Andy pulled that in. And where this starts out with would be, how can you see the world through the lens of figuring things out instead of following a process, following a procedure? It's like the tail wagging the dog, and it always drives me crazy. So that's really the first thing. It's like, if I can change my mindset so I'm working towards the outcomes, as Andy talked about, instead of the outputs, and I can change my mindset to think of it in terms of lean, which is do as little as possible to learn and to adapt, then I can begin to act accordingly based on what the world around me is saying. And now there's got to be processes and procedures wrapped around that, but how lightweight can you make them would be all the difference, going back to the simplicity topic that Ian really drove in. And my only difference in all the conversation would be around quality. And I do think quality is important, but I think quality has to grow based on success. I think we spend too much time making something good when we don't know if it's even going to be something that's needed or wanted or valued. So once we figure out what somebody wants, and then we work towards making it better over time. And I think that's the piece that I sometimes get frustrated with, because quality is important, but it's quality once you know what people want and what people are willing to exchange time or money for. But anyways, fascinating conversation, because as human beings, we just want to follow a process, but that's what's going to kill us in the end. We have to follow how things should be done in the mindset of working.
I want to expand our conversation around mindset. So leading change often comes up as an area needing improvement for PMs, and change is a hot topic at the moment. A lot of companies are carrying out projects that involve change management, but PMs will also need to apply an adaptive mindset to their work. Ian, how do project managers need to become more adaptive and more change ready themselves?
Yeah, great. I think first of all, too, we should maybe talk about project managers who kind of typically should focus on an output. And I know that might sound like I'm contradicting Andy's earlier comment, but I'll explain in a moment. Program of work managers focusing more on outcomes, and then portfolio managers and similar type people, EPMOs, for example, leaders focusing more on business value. There is a bit of a connection between that string of delivery focused things from output to outcome, and then outcome leading to the capture of business value. To your specific question, Lauren, to me, project managers, irrespective of how big or small the work that they're doing, need to, in my view, continue to develop themselves from a skill set perspective, but also they need to develop themselves from an experiential point of view. If they continue to do the same thing, even though it may be a project, but a similar type project, similar size project, a project that has similar levels of complexity or similar levels of risk, then they're never going to improve. So we do know that we look forward, we're going to have a much more volatile and complex business environment, global environment for that matter, that's going to challenge us. So to me, people need to keep challenging themselves, gain more experience, and focus actually perhaps on PMI's talent triangle, which I think just spot on in terms of technical skills, leadership skills, and business management skills, strategic and business management skills. To me, that strategic and business management skills, together with the leadership component, should enhance their technical capabilities to offer, I think, something much more to a delivery at a project level, as well as delivery at a program of work level. So that would be my sort of kind of short pick there, Lauren.
And did you want to jump in here? I know you're quite passionate around the topic of adaptive leadership.
I think any form of manager or leader, whatever you want to call them, I think the movement is now away from the traditional approach that came from the Taylorist view of the world, which was the workers did what they were told and the managers told them what to do. So I think the project manager's shift needs to be the same. Traditionally, that's what the project managers told the people working in the project what to do. The shift now is a lot more towards more of a facilitated role. So yes, the project manager is often going to be accountable for the outcomes of the project, but they're there to really facilitate those outcomes rather than direct them. So I think that's going to be a big shift as well, is to change their focus away from telling people what to do to actually removing impediments, to coaching, to helping people understand the purpose of the project and keep that foremost, to provide transparency around the outcomes or how the project's delivery, and really focus more on what I think is a more modern view of leadership than the traditional project manager role that of the past.
Yeah, and I guess speaking about traditional views, David spoke in the intro about traditional iron triangle being the measure of success in projects. And Ian, you spoke about this before, but how do we move to a focus on value delivery?
Yeah, I think, again, it's one of those pivot things. So earlier we talked about simplifying business in terms of, you know, achieving an agile delivery mindset to start challenging the business and the business rules, the business processes, the business leadership, to Andy's good point. So I think if we can challenge that and find ways to simplify it, then we bring in a business philosophy. And that's a key thing, because without the business philosophy, all organizations will run the risk of building yet more process. So the business philosophy needs to be able to sustain the simplification desire and at the same time inform the culture of the organization so that we get maybe not necessarily a physically flattened structure, but in terms of doing work, we get a much flatter structure, as it were, organizational structure. And again, to Andy's good point, where teams are coming together and they're collaborating perhaps better than they were in the past, and making decisions because they're empowered to make decisions more so than perhaps they've been in the past, those things will allow the organization to speed up. And if you can speed up and maintain, like I said, a level of quality, then great things begin to happen. And all of a sudden, your organization then is an organization that is and does become adaptive to whatever new challenges it might face.
And I guess in terms of speaking about new challenges, there's very much a movement away from projects to a focus on products and moving to a project portfolio view. In what are your thoughts on this? How do we make that shift?
Yeah, again, I think the move to products, I think maybe just within the ICT sector, and I kind of bracket those ICT things, so apologies if it's not quite the right term. Other sectors that I engage with certainly don't seem to have those same sort of conversations or have those same thoughts. But nevertheless, it's a great point. And I think in terms of coupling that together with a portfolio view is a good thing, because the whole notion of product and product management is to kind of bundle things together in the same way that lean management or lean methodology taught us many, many years ago. I even think I have a certificate on that, actually, would you believe, which is, I'll not tell you how old it is, but it is pretty old, actually. But, but what it told us is the ability to focus and the ability to work smart and optimize stuff. Those lessons are still very much apt today than they were, 20, 25 years ago. So I think whether it's product from within a sector or not, bundling work together in a smarter way through a portfolio window or portfolio grouping certainly will allow an organization to perform work in a more efficient manner, thereby achieving value earlier or delivering value earlier. It will allow that same organization to focus around and connect its strategic intent through strategic goals together with its business objectives, which are typically the hardwired stuff that go into plan. So all of a sudden, we've got a bit of synergy between what's intended from a big picture perspective versus what's actually done and delivered on any given period. That gap then that traditionally has been there starts to close quite a bit. And again, the organization gains through efficiency, more profitability if you're in a for-profit environment, if you're in a non-profit environment, more efficiency, more perhaps societal good, happy customers, happy people, etc.
And David, I'd like to get your thoughts. This isn't a new concept, but one that I know a lot of businesses are struggling with. So what's your perspective?
Well, I'm interested, as I'm listening to Andy's side and I listen to Ian's side, Ian's got a great deal of experience across multiple sectors in how to make the operation of project management, portfolio management, and program management effective and efficient. And it's interesting when I hear him speak about that, it's almost like sometimes we forget that. And I think sometimes agilists forget that too. When you're dealing with a very complex, complicated organization that has multiple, you know, programs of and a portfolio of billions of dollars of projects running around, that there has to be this way to operationalize that successfully. And that's where you can even take that product mindset, where you're looking at that, as Ian said, bundling some of those programs together and then trying to find ways to get people to work on things so they can overlap the skills. The best example I can say is I was an economics major. When I took my 300 and 400 level classes, I made sure my five classes had overlap. So it was really like I was taking three classes instead of five classes, and it helped me get good grades and not have to work as hard. And so I like that. And I think that's really important. But I also think that there is the other element of product mindset and project management and understanding each element that's going on around defining what it is your customer wants based on your customer persona and really attacking it on that future state design before you even execute the work that's being done. And as we get into it more and more, it's almost like a battleground between who is going to do the best job of owning that future state design and try to define value about what is going to be done. Is it going to be a BA? Is it going to be an internal product manager? Is it going to be an agile type leadership role? Is it going to be the project management? And I think it's going to be interesting to find out what happens, but I think you can see product in both those ways. One, as you have this large dynamic portfolio, how do you put those into buckets and manage them from a product mentality so you can get efficiency and better operation? And then how do you look at what you're providing at a point and say, what it is I'm providing, how does it meet my constituency? What's my constituency persona? So we can get closer and closer to value with the delivery. It was really interesting, Ian, hearing you speak about that. It kind of hit a light bulb for me.
Thank you.
Can I make a, depends on the context of the project. So a lot of projects are there to provide products or services. And obviously I'm, again, predominantly speaking from my perspective of working in the tech space. So again, I realize that there are a lot of building projects and other things that are not related to that. But in the context of building a service or a product, then it makes a lot of sense, especially if you are following not the water scrumful, but the proper agile DevOps, whatever you want to call, delivery approach, where you're delivering fast and frequently, often building from a very lightweight start, where you'll evolve your product over time. Well, in that context, it makes total sense to have long-lived teams because you're going to start with a very small, lightweight product and evolve it over time, depending on what feedback you get from your customers. So I think the other aspect that goes with that is that there's a high level of productivity gained or lost when a project team forms and then is disbanded. So that's another reason why people do this, is that you gain a lot of your productivity probably within about 6 months of start. So you're going to lose that if you then stop. So I think that's one key aspect. If you're doing incremental rapid delivery, then that's going to be the way, and it makes sense to have a long-lived team, product team working on that. And I think the other aspect that I would also bring in, a lot of now organizations are now starting to restructure their businesses, not only the IT, but the businesses around services, customer services, which may be represented by products. So if you're going to organize your organization around services, customer services, then it makes sense to have long-lived teams to support those. So I think this is just another aspect that's happening, that's lending itself to me in a natural way to move away from a pure project focus to a more product, long-lived, customer-led focus.
Yeah, and Andy, speaking of reorganization, I want to talk about the PMO. So I read some pretty interesting research recently that said 40% of organizations are using a centralized PMO, but a really large number, I think it was upwards of 30%, have actually disestablished a PMO in the last 2 years. Ian, let's start with you. What's going on here? How can PMOs foster, I guess, better decision-making and prioritization for investment?
Gosh, I don't think we've got enough time to cover this topic, that's for sure. But look, there's no question that PMOs do get a bad rap, and in a lot of cases, well-deserved. And I think your statistics just underlined that nicely, actually. I think in some cases, though, they get undeservedly bad rap. And that's unfortunate because maybe there's a disconnect between the business need or the business communication of the need at the point in time versus the need to try and corral and bridge between a strategic or business objective intent versus getting stuff done on a day-to-day basis, whether it's project or program, etc. Yeah, look, I think just very quickly, two of the biggest issues that cause PMOs to fail is, one, the process and the heavy process that's often put in place, which kind of puts organizational handcuffs on. Secondly, the people capabilities within that team, whether it's a project management office, program management office, or even a portfolio management office. Quite often, the capabilities are kind of mismatched with what the actual organization needs. So what, on the flip side, however, and picking up the back end of your question, in terms of better decision-making and prioritization of portfolios, whether it's products grouped together, to Andy's point, into portfolios or some other rationale, it doesn't really matter what we call it. At the end of the day, we have a small number of strategic goals that we're trying to achieve that get represented by a whole bunch of business objectives. How we package that doesn't really matter as long as we get it done. To me, an EPMO, an enterprise portfolio management office, is the way forward. And that can be the mechanism that really, come back to one of the earlier questions and comments by you all, can be the vehicle that actually facilitates value being planned, value being captured, and value being captured, whether it's internally or externally, to the organization. So an EPMO staffed with the right capabilities of skills and leadership capability could actually, in my view, provide a huge amount of plus to an organization's well-beings, particularly that translational strategy into operational intent.
Yeah, Andy, Ian said that this is complicated and it's context dependent, which I think is true. Can you add to that?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think I've seen this as well. And I think part of the issue is structural as well, that EPMOs or PMOs have often bounced around between different parts of the organization. So sometimes they've been part of finance because it's about investments and managing investments. Sometimes they're part of IT because that's where a lot of the big projects are. And they have, I think, gained somewhat of a bad name, as Ian pointed out, often through heavy governance and process and being the process police, which is part of their role, frankly. They're there to help provide transparency on the money that the business has invested. But probably too much has gone into that side of it, enforcing standards and pushing things down and not actually focusing on enough on an enablement role. So I think part of the shift should be towards more changing the terminology to enablement. But within that, to talk about some of the key things that any business is going to require, which is still going to be, as Ian pointed out, how do we align what we're doing with the business from a strategy point of view? How do we measure that? And how do we provide transparency to the business on how things are going? Senior leaders should know and want to know. Board members want to know what risk there is within some of these projects. So providing common tools and approaches to help provide transparency around the status is actually a critical area that they can provide. Also helping to try and make sure that there are sort of some level of lightweight standards or governance rules that help provide clarity to enable this sort of transparency is another thing as well. So you don't want to be telling people what to do, but you are going to be needing to require them to provide you information to help you answer questions. So that's a specific thing that a PMO can do. And I think the other key area that I've seen them move towards, and sometimes this term now, value delivery, a value delivery office, is also to help really help the project teams have a very clear understanding on how value should be measured and how projects need to align to a value delivery model, a value model, and that will help determine what funding, what priority those projects get in the longer term as well. So I actually agree with Ian that there's a high need for this level of strategic alignment. A good EPMO or VDO is critical, I think, for larger organizations to help create that alignment and transparency, some level of lightweight standards and governance, tool sets possibly, but more of, from my point of view, more importantly, the methodology about how projects will be valued and what will determine which one gets started and what the ongoing funding will be and what needs to happen to keep that ongoing funding. That's a critical role of a central team.
Now, David, I know you'll have some thoughts here.
Yes, indeed.
Oh, no.
You know, a couple things out of all this. The first thing is anything that has power and control is going to get corrupted. So the basic concept of the PMO in some ways built out that corruption. It's a centralized repository. It wants command. It wants control. And it's going to be the tail wagging the dog ultimately, unless there's really strong leadership who understands, you know, what their goal, what their charter is. As I start thinking about the PMO, it really should be an organization to train, coach, and support the project managers out there in the field, giving them the tool sets and the skills and the help to deal with a very difficult and very challenging job. It's almost like a counseling center and an education center. And I would love to see that happen. But of course, in our human frailties, like the human work machine we talked about last podcast, power comes with a lot of cognitive disruption and distortion. Now, going to the EPO and the valued management office, both are critically needed. But the challenge is, how do we train and build the skills of the person or people who would live in that office? And there's so many things they need to have. First off, corporate America doesn't allow for this to occur at the C-suite because the C-suite's too invested in saving money or making money to make their stock price go up so they can do stock buyback so they can all make their bonus. So really, this is a challenge. This is the issue. And I think both Andy and Ian pointed to it as this could solve the problem. But I think the underlying issue is, what skills do they need to have and how are they organized? So they kept lightweight without getting that whole thing that happened to the PMO and the tail wagging the dog. But the skill sets are wide ranging. That's what scares me about it. I mean, just trying to teach project managers about value and the complexity that value brings to the table can be quite difficult. Not the fact that they're not smart. It's just that value in and of itself is even a very complex topic. And those are the things that hit my mind when we were talking or as they were talking.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Dave. I want to close up with a final question. PMI indicated we're going to need a lot more people in project roles in the next 7 years. Ian, you spoke earlier about the need for nimbleness, and Dave was just talking about skill sets. In today's fast-changing world, what other skills and capabilities do project managers need?
Great question. Look, I think, again, let's go back to PMI talent triangle, where we've got technical skills. They will be needed. Of course they will. Maybe there's too much emphasis on technical skills, which gets us into the debate about methodology one versus methodology two versus process X versus process Y. To me, whilst those conversations have some merit at a technical delivery element way down in an org structure, to me, it's more about the other parts of that talent triangle that people in the project program and portfolio management profession should be focusing on, i.e. leadership skills and enhancing their leadership capabilities and skill sets, but also adopting and experiencing and learning more business acumen together with some strategic understanding. Doesn't mean they become strategists or business gurus, but you know, allowing themselves to learn more about that so that when the VUCA influence world forces yet more change on any organization, big or small, then those people are well ready to kind of positively. So I think there needs to be a focus on purpose. There needs to be leadership culture, needs to be strong interpersonal skills, a deep understanding, and this is the business management, deep understanding versus risk and reward and the trade-off of those. And at the end of the day, judgment. Head, heart, and gut, I refer to it as. Head, of course, the heart, the passion, and that relates back to the purpose and culture of an organization. And the gut, the old traditional judgment. Gosh, this didn't work before. Why? Because X, Y, and Z, whatever. Just that, sometimes that sixth sense of judgment can be a fantastic thing to assist in a quick assessment of issues, quick assessment of options to redress those.
Love it. Head, heart, and gut.
Yep.
Well, thank you all for your thoughts. And thank you, Ian, for joining us for this podcast. We could talk about this for a while, but I think we might just need to get you back. It's been great to have you share your vast experience and your wisdom with us. And you put up with our banter. So we thank you for that, too.
Thank you. Thank you so much, guys.
You're listening to the Better Work Project. If you enjoyed this episode, then make sure to share it with a friend or 10. Until next time, thanks for your company. Stay safe.
Thank you for joining us on this edition of the Better Work Project. If you like this episode, please be sure to rate, review, and tell your friends and colleagues about it. If you have specific suggestions or ideas for future podcasts, please do not hesitate to reach out to us. Continue to fight the good fight. We'll see you the next time on the Better Work Project. Thank you.